and found that it could not be done. He said, "What can they do about it? Send me home?"
"They can instruct me to remove you from the ground team and bring you up here."
Lee's voice flared.
"They can insist that I send Dr. O'Hara to the surface and keep you in orbit for the remainder of the mission."
Jamie felt his guts lurch. "You wouldn't do that?" It was more of a question than a statement.
"They have not ordered me to do so. Not yet."
"Thank God," Jamie breathed silently.
"However, they want a clarification of your words. A written statement from you as to what they mean to you and why you said them instead of what you had been instructed to say."
It suddenly struck Jamie as ludicrous. Sitting inside a spacesuit on a world 100 million kilometers from Earth, he was being told that he had to write an apology for 3 words he had blurted unthinkingly, or be punished like a truant schoolboy.
"You will write such a statement?"
Lee prompted. "If I don't?"
"They will insist on removing you from the ground team, I fear. You must recall that your assignment to the landing team at the last minute caused some anxious moments in Washington and elsewhere. Please do not jeopardize your position any further."
Jamie remembered that frantic weekend of hurried telephone conferences and impromptu visits with his family, and Edith saying goodbye to him. The expedition commander seemed to draw himself up into a taller, calmer, more regal posture.
"My advice, for what it is worth, is to write a brief statement that explains how you were overwhelmed with emotion upon stepping onto the surface of Mars and lapsed into the language of your ancestors. No one can fault you for that."
"It's even the truth," Jamie said. The Chinese allowed himself a fatherly smile.
"You see, a soft answer turns away wrath."
Jamie nodded. "I see. Thank you." Dossier, James Fox Waterman. Jamie was 9 years old the first time he was sent back to New Mexico to spend the summer with his grandfather, Al. His mother did not like the idea, but she and her husband had a summer of foreign travel ahead of them, lectures and seminars that would take the two professors across the Pacific to Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, and Hong Kong. They had little desire to drag their 9-year-old with them, and no intention whatever of turning down the all-expenses-paid junket. So for the first time since he had been in kindergarten, Jamie returned to Santa Fe. He learned to fish and hunt and to love his grandfather Al, even though he actually spent most of his days in Al's store on the plaza in Santa Fe. Al was a good grandfather, but a better businessman. Anglo ladies cooed over the little Indian boy all summer long. The very last week, while Jamie was already moping about his return to Berkeley, Al took him to one of the Navajo pueblos up in the mountains, where he bought the pottery and carpets for which the Anglo tourists paid so dearly. Most of Al's business that day was conducted at the trading post, a combination bar and general store, with uncarpeted creaking floorboards, worn old wooden counters, warped shelves half bare, and a big ceiling fan that hardly moved at all. A half dozen older men sat at the bar, silent and virtually motionless beneath their drooping broad-brimmed hats, while Al bargained patiently, interminably in Navajo with the Pueblo's head man. To Jamie, the old men at the bar seemed as dusty and time-ravaged as the room itself. Bored with his grandfather's endless, low-pitched haggling in a language he did not understand, Jamie went outside and sat on the sagging wooden steps. The late afternoon sun felt hot as molten lava, coloring the whole land copper red. A scrawny cat slinked past his feet, gray and silent. A pair of mangy, mean-eyed dogs lay panting in the dust on the other side of the street beneath the shade of a cottonwood tree. Jamie could count their ribs. Across the way, on the shaded porch that fronted an adobe house badly in need of patching, a little girl, maybe 6 or 7 years old, was playing with a puppy, a joyful bundle of wriggling fur. Jamie thought about going over to her, but he did not know how to speak Navajo. The girl cuddled the puppy, petted it, crooning to it in her language. She put the puppy down briefly, then picked it up by its tail. The pup yelped and snapped at her. She dropped the puppy and jumped to her feet. Then, breaking into English, she cried, "You bad boy! Bad! You always want make trouble, always fighting! I send you to principal! Get out of this classroom! Go to principal! I tell your mother on you!" Even though he was only 9, Jamie immediately recognized that the girl was imitating an Anglo school teacher. Her mother called from the cool darkness of the house, through its open door, and spoke sternly in Navajo to her. Jamie realized his grandfather was standing beside him now, laughing at the scene. Scrambling to his feet, Jamie asked, "What did she say, Al?" "Ah, she just told her daughter not to hurt the puppy," he laughed. "Then she told her not to make jokes about her teacher in front of a white man." "A white man?" "You, son. But I'm not a white man." "Guess you look like one to her," said Al. The following week, Jamie was sent back to Berkeley, where his parents expressed great pleasure that their son had not turned into a wild Indian. Mars Orbit. It was damned annoying to be a sage. Li Chengdu stared at the blank comm screen and still saw James Waterman's stubborn face. An honest face, slightly square, with broad cheekbones and just a hint of distant Asian ancestry in the shape of his eyes. Piercing black eyes that were an open pathway to the young man's soul. "I should not have lost my temper with him," Li scolded himself. "I was angry because he is down there on the planet, and I am forced to ride in this celestial tin can without ever setting foot on Mars." There was more to it than that, he knew. Russians, Americans, Japanese, 19 different nationalities living cheek by jowl 100 million kilometers from Earth. If there isn't a mental breakdown before we return home, I'll be surprised beyond words. Not even the Japanese were meant to live this close together. The engineers had anticipated all the physical problems of the Mars mission, but they had studiously ignored the worries of the psychologists. No, rather, they had passed over all those worries by ordering the psychologists to pick well-balanced personalities who could remain stable even under the pressure cooker conditions of this mission. Li did not know whether he should laugh or weep. Remain stable under these conditions? How does a man remain stable when he is supposed to deny himself sex for nearly 2 years? This mission should have been planned by Polynesians, not Russians and Americans, the two most prudish peoples in the world. And now, this American Indian has his government upset with his foolish words. That is something none of us had planned for. At least the crowding had eased now that half the ship's complement had departed for the surface. Li leaned back in his softly yielding chair. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw the ruddy curve of Mars float past in his compartment's round window. The orbiting Mars 2 spacecraft was still tethered to its Mars 1 twin, 5 kilometers away, the two of them still rotating about their common center to maintain a feeling of Martian-level gravity. If it became necessary to send one of the backup personnel down to the surface, he or she could go instantly. They were all acclimated to the gravity of Mars. Li was grateful that their long voyage had not required them to live in zero gravity for any length of time. He always became nauseous in zero gravity. Even thinking of unending months of it made him feel queasy. Sighing heavily, he pushed his chair away from the comm console and stood up, almost 6.5 feet tall, lean as a broom handle. The tightly buttoned collar of his coveralls hid the old scar on his throat, a reminder of the riots during his student days in Shanghai. The only decoration on the olive drab outfit was his name tag on the left breast and the shoulder patch of the first Martian expedition. Silly of the Americans to be troubled over a few words, he thought. Yet they have never fully resolved their problems with the Indians. Li frowned. No, they did not call them Indians anymore. Native Americans? Amerinds? Words are important, he realized, especially in a nation ruled by its media. As commander of the first Martian expedition, Li Chengdu had both absolute power and absolute responsibility. 2 dozen human beings were under his charge, their very lives in his hands. Half of them, the envied half, were down on the surface of Mars. Waterman was not the first choice among the geologists, not even the second, but the young man is down there on the surface of Mars. His Tao is so powerful that it shapes and transforms the paths of all others who come in touch with him, even my own. Those of us remaining up here, coasting in orbit, secretly consider ourselves second rate. There is